Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio here today by David Heater, David Heater, Head of Digital at Stylists. Hi, David. Welcome.
Hello.
And the mobile phone buzzing in the background, of course, belongs to CEO of Exchange Wire, Kieran O'Kane. Hi, Kieran.
Hello, Rachel.
I liked the wave. I'm sure our listeners would really appreciate that.
Well, it'll look good on Spotify or iTunes, yes, for sure.
Yes, we're streaming it live. No, we're not, actually. On Facebook live. No, we're not, actually. Maybe we should, actually, for the crack. I think maybe we should stream it live.
We have done live versions of the podcast before, haven't we? But with an audience. But maybe we should do it one time without
I'm not on Facebook, but, you know, Sound Guy's telling me to...
Sound Guy's telling you to behave in front of the microphone.
Sorry, Sound Guy.
Right, let's get started. So kicking off, the first news story I wanted to chat with you guys about appeared in Axios at the end of last week. It's also off the back of a story that's been rolling around for a while, which we've talked about at least once on the podcast, and that is the FTC conducting a review into alleged monopolistic behaviour of some of the big and very familiar tech companies, the likes of Google, Facebook, Amazon, probably even Apple, I think. Certainly Microsoft are included in that. And how they've built their businesses off the back of acquisitions. Now, this particular news story came out because it turns out that the FTC are looking into a specific area of acquisitions, which is actually any acquisitions that happened within those companies since 2010 that fell under the threshold for what would be considered suitable to look at from an anti-competitive point of view. So these are effectively acquisitions that were too small for the FTC to be interested in at the time. The reason that they've gone back to these or that they've gone to these in the first instance at all is because through their regular sort of level of investigation, they've decided that it was probably pivotal to a number of these businesses to acquire a series of small technology solutions and roll them into their existing technology stack. And that in doing that, that gave them an upper hand over the competition and created an environment where no one could afford to compete with them. At least that's the premise. Nothing obviously has been proven yet, but it's really interesting. And I wanted to hear what you guys have to think about this, because it sounds to me like this is a hell of a lot of work. There's also something else actually that's interesting connected to this I'll mention, which is that part of this investigation came out that when Google acquired Invite Media, however long that was, probably about 2010 actually, wasn't it? Yeah. It turns out that Invite shed a load of cash in order to be considered as part of that acquisition under the threshold that we were talking about, so therefore they weren't subject to an extra level of scrutiny. Now, there's been an investigation into that. No wrongdoing was found, but I think this is what's led the FTC to wanting to look into all of this in a little bit more detail. So what are we seeing here? Is it a case of another intense layer of scrutiny that's going to tell us something about how these big tech companies have built themselves? Is it actually going to lead to anything that is useful for the tech companies of tomorrow? Will it even lead to behaviour that's going to either undo some of these acquisitions or enable the government to undertake some findings that will break some of these companies apart? Where do you think this is going to go? I'm going to go to you first, David.
I mean, I think that, you know, companies shedding assets pre-acquisition is not unusual. And you know, all of the reports are saying that nobody's done anything illegal at the moment. Depending on what comes out of the FTC investigation, I think it's highly unlikely that they will be broken up. It will be incredibly difficult to unwind, say, the old Invite Media business, the DSP business, from Google now without splitting up Google. And so I don't think it will lead to that. It might lead to some slaps on the wrist, but I'm not sure that it will necessarily lead to anything other than some speculation and a little bit of, as I said, wrist slapping.
Yeah, interesting. Kieran?
I mean, you know, it's like you go into a fight with Google and you expect the Queen's be rules, but they fight like an MMA fighter, like dirty fighting, like, you know, elbows smash the crap out of you, headbutting, you know, eye gouging. I'm not, this type of thing I'm not surprised about. You know, Google shouldn't have been allowed to buy a lot of assets. One, they should not have been allowed to buy DoubleClick. I don't know how that deal should have... 2007, this is where all this started, right? It literally let... It's a bit like, you know, you've seen Lost Boys. You know when they invite the vampire, head vampire into the house.
Into the house.
And renders them powerless. That's exactly what happened to display advertising when Google was bought DoubleClick. It was a disaster.
When you're saying Google shouldn't have been allowed to do this, do you mean they shouldn't have been allowed to acquire Invite Media? What do you mean?
So all of those little sort of
The smaller acquisitions.
Small acquisitions let them wrap up the market, right? So, put the cards on the table. Invite Media was built by Ipon Web, by the way. And Ipon Web's code was running inside the Google stack for many, many years. It drove the Google people mad. Big hat tip to the Ipon Web boys there. But, these little sort of acquisitions, I mean, you could argue that Google kind of saw stuff coming, so they bought Invite, killed the DSP market a little bit. Actually killed the acquisition price. By buying it for less than 100 million, it destroyed the valuations of the likes of MediaMath and the rest, who could have probably sold for 300-400 million, and it had to raise more money. And really, the DSP market didn't recover in terms of M&A. The Trade Desk is an outlier because it went public and it's now worth 10 billion. Okay, that's a massive outlier, but it did kill the M&A market straight off the bat because Google Invite Media, was about to say Ipon Web, but they did buy Ipon Web's tech.
Prediction.
But remember, the Invite Media at the time had Publicis Media business in their hands, and you know basically it was just buy us because we own one of the biggest holding groups in their programmatic spend, and they've used Invite Media as a tool to kind of like own that. Programmatic market, like you argued, the DSP market is completely skewed towards two or three companies globally. Like DV360 is the leader, and the Trade Desk have done a fantastic job to build that independent layer. Like MediaMath, I'm not so sure they're in the US, but not internationally. But they've used these smaller acquisitions to kill. I mean, they bought AdMeld, right? So, you know, which basically powered the AdX business effectively, because the SSP and AdX business were sort of combined into this behemoth.
So here's the question, right? It's interesting that these investigations are being undertaken now, because, you know, that's a really interesting sort of synopsis of you know, the M&A landscape of ad tech for the last 10 years. But the fact that they're looking into these acquisitions now begs the question, what will happen as a result? Because it's not like they can sort of roll back on those acquisitions. I mean, they could try, but that would be really difficult. Then, like you alluded to, David, does it actually mean that they will use this as a sort of stick with which to beat these big tech companies and try to break them apart? Not sure. That also feels like a really big potential play. So what could the end result be that they just introduce more legislation and more layers of bureaucracy for anyone that's looking for acquisitions from here onwards? And if they do that, is that going to be to the benefit of the industry, or is it actually going to be detrimental to companies who are, you know, I suppose, not likely to ever otherwise be acquired and might really struggle to get through the kind of administrative processes that they put in place? Is that going to create a barrier rather than a solution?
I mean, I think, you know, you're not necessarily seeing so much M&A from outside of the ad industry anyway at the moment. More of it is mergers within. You know, you look at Telaria and Rubicon recently, and I think you'll see more of those take place. One of the really interesting questions that I was thinking about when I read this story was, if I was a VC and I'd invested in Invite and they had wiped as much as has been indicated off of that company price, actually when they sold, I would, depending on what comes out of the investigation, I would potentially be looking to recoup some of those losses, because actually my shares were, in reality, worth a lot more.
You could sue Google for that, I reckon.
It's interesting that they say no wrongdoing has been found at this stage.
But if you force a sale deliberately, I don't know, I'm not getting into legal quagmire here because I don't know enough about it, right? And I don't have the legal credentials. I could probably say I do, but I don't.
Well, you could certainly say that you do, because you like to claim many credentials, Kieran, whether you've actually
argue they got Invite on the dirt cheap, and the two boys that ran it were delighted to get 98 million. And you know what? Brian O'Kelly, Boris, Mr. Zawadzki at MediaMath, Joe, they all made a bundle of money as well, because they all invested in early. But you could argue that actually Invite Media was sold at a song high, considering how big the programmatic market has become.
Well, and like James says, if you were another investor in that company, off. You'd be very annoyed.
Very pissed off about that, actually. Because that could have been a 500 or 600 million acquisition, easily. Because like Google were not even in the game. They weren't even involved. Like that was a panic buy. And then they've done, like the thing about Google is, they may, like I think where this particular argument's going is that the is it the FTC or the DOJ that's doing this?
So there's an FTC investigation. I'm just about to mention the DOJ on another point, though. Go ahead.
But I think that they're trying to make a point that Google's made, or Google and others have used these smaller buys to kind of kill the competition. Yeah. You know. And you could argue they did the same with YouTube. Like YouTube has killed the video market because they own it, right? And if you look at the numbers on Google's P&L, I mean, I think Google plays a different game from the rest of us. I just think even the point you made there, Rich, is like the chessboard is complicated. Google's playing a chess game. We're playing catch up here, right? The company's already, I personally think they're getting out of ad tech. I think they're going to get rid of their ad tech stack because they've realized that there's no upside for them for this, right? I don't know if there's a slide here on their TV here in the studio,
which listeners can't see.
Yeah, but it's about Google's. It's about basically Google ID versus now versus what's going to happen post Chrome and Sandbox and all the rest of it. So you can get information in, but you can't get it out, and it's through their cloud infrastructure. So you can almost think that Google's moved ahead and say, you know what, the ad business for us is just. Well, particularly display business, is just a proxy to get more cloud business, right? The only thing that matters to Google is search. That is 100% theirs. It's the golden egg that keeps on laying golden egg after. They've literally used that as a means to batter the crap out of the rest of the industry, right?
So you've got an interesting piece coming forward on this, Ciaran. I don't want you to go too far into spoiler territory, but David, what do you think about that? Do you think Google cares more about search than ads? And could you see them getting out of the ad business?
I mean, I think this certainly adds to the cause that they, you know, if I was sitting at Google now and I was looking at it and going, well, you know what, we're getting hammered for our Invite Media. We're going to get probably hammered for our double click as well. We've got search over here that is our main business. I'd potentially look to get rid. But then you've got to question what value, you know, if you spun those two parts of the business out on their own, what value they have outside of being linked together and having that Google backing behind them.
I do go into that in the piece itself and make an argument as to what will happen next. So stay tuned, listeners. Next week, it's a big piece.
That was the trailer for Ciaran's piece to be published any minute now. The other point I wanted to make further to the notion of, well, where is this actually going to go? Because it's all good and well to investigate something after the fact, but what can you do about it? There was a suggestion in the article that one of the things that the DOJ could do, because the DOJ are busy looking into anti-competitive behaviour within these companies as well, is force them to do something as a result by way of kind of making up for past wrongs. So apparently in the T-Mobile acquisition of Sprint, the DOJ included in that it couldn't go ahead unless they set up a sort of seed fund for new competitive players in the industry. Yeah, I know. Like, we've got a bit of head shaking going on there. You don't think it'll make any difference?
They own the feckin' ecosystem. I mean, they own the browser. Like, the only way to do it is get them to divest of one of the assets they have, because they have complete control over our ecosystem. Like, it's just not a fair game. Like, imagine that Google, we'll set up a VC fund. For what? So we can build products on top of Google's infrastructure and they decide what happens next. This is just not a fair game. It's not a fair fight. We're not even fighting fair here. Like the guy, you're fighting a guy that's twice the size of you, and you've got your two arms wrapped around your fucking neck and a blindfold, and you're sitting in a wheelchair. Like, you know, they wheel you in to get battered up. I mean, this is not a fair fight.
Yeah, I think
it's not. But I think if I was Google, I would also argue that actually through those acquisitions, the money that I pumped into the system allowed spin outs of things like Instagram, Pinterest, Airbnb, all from former Google employees, all of whom were, you know, had companies that were acquired. If I was them, I would argue we've already done that. We've already helped other parts of the tech system.
You could shoot that down in one breath. Like, you could argue that the search business is still growing at a clip, right? And there's one company that controls 95% of it, right? They were allowed to buy DoubleClick, which I still think is one of the worst decisions ever made, one of the worst oversights ever by the DOJ and the EU about that.
Yes, he's made that.
And I make it again, absolutely crazy. Crazy is the word I would use. But they've done it. I was going to go. You just interrupted me there.
Because we're running out of time there. You were in full flow rant.
But what was the point I was trying to make?
Something about double click being an awful buy.
And you being able to shoot down the notion that Google have already, you know, seeded some kind of innovation in other companies.
Google have stifled innovation. They've stifled innovation because they've bought up. Like all the assets they bought,
all the competition.
Right? They bought DoubleClick, just one. DoubleClick, Invite, AdMel. They bought AdMob. They bought Android. These are not innovation. They have bought this to kill the competition, and it's not. I think the DOJ and the states and the EU have had enough, and Google now are on the back foot, right? So they're not going to be reactive. They're going to be proactive. So you'll see them go to the table with a deal. Go, please. Leave us alone. We'll do this, this, and this. They're not going to wait for this to happen to them. And I'll tell you what, they're already telegraphing that they're going to get rid of something. They're going to offer it up as a sacrificial lamb. And that's in the piece next week. Stay tuned, readers.
No more spoilers.
With that, let's move on to the next news story of the week. There was an interesting blog post that appeared on the Ad Monsters blog this week, talking about how in order for the ad tech industry to kind of move to ad tech 2.0, the new world, the new universe of what ad tech will look like from 2020 beyond, which we know is going to be cookie-less or needs to be cookie-less, it needs to kind of unlearn AdTech 1.0. So the premise here is that the technology part of the advertising and marketing industry specifically has been built on a whole set of assumptions that are shaky, to say the least, and have definitely been put under threat as a result of the disappearance of third-party cookie targeting. So the idea is that ad tech as we know it and all the money that goes into programmatic and data-driven advertising isn't just going to vanish overnight. It will be redirected. The industry will still survive and still find a way to kind of thrive. But in order for it to do that, we're going to have to unlearn some really fundamental tactics and techniques. And what's interesting about this piece, which is why I wanted some opinions on it from you guys today, is that it puts at the heart of it the notion that marketers who are kind of, I suppose you could draw a little bit of a picture of them to say that they've kind of been pushed around by ad tech, if you like, over the last 10 years. They've spent the last 10 years not quite always, this is not every marketer in the industry, obviously, not quite always understanding exactly what they need from a technology point of view or how to go about getting that or what the best application of or best use and application of that tool is. They've sort of perhaps finally got to an understanding of what programmatic means and, you know, what data-driven advertising means and what technology solutions are available out there. And now it's kind of all changed. So they're going to be spending the next little while working out what of the technology tools that they're currently using still works, what doesn't work, and what that can be replaced by, and are those replacements privacy compliant, and then how are they going to measure the impact of those technology tools on their campaigns. And the point of this piece is to say, you know, the wheels of change can be slow once you've already established the ways in which you like to work. And the biggest threat facing the ad tech industry from the point of view of the author of this particular piece, whose name escapes me, I didn't jot it down, but check out the Ad Monsters blog. The point of this is that ad tech needs to learn this lesson much faster than it's currently showed its ability to be able to do, because otherwise we're going to miss out on an opportunity. Thoughts? I'm going to go to you first, David, because Kieran will otherwise threaten spoilers of future pieces before we know it.
Sorry.
I always go back to GDPR actually with this and the invent of that. When we had a 2-year deadline on something, we knew it was coming. And let's be fair, everybody was still scrambling around at the end of, you know, at the end of April 2017, I think it was, still trying to sign DPAs with everybody because none of us had got into gear and none of us had got organized enough, publishers and marketers side and ad tech side as well. The death of the cookie is not a new thing. Apple killed it in their ecosystem 18 months ago, and still very few companies are able to operate in that system. You know, there's a few examples of ones that do. You know, LiveRamp, InfoSum, Permutive are the three that come to mind. Whereas most people stuck their head in the sand and just didn't want to know. You know, none of the ad tech partners came out and said, "Hey, we've got this idea. We're going to talk about identity. We're going to do this." I think Index have come out and they've got their identity wrapper, but other than that, everybody else all of the other ad tech companies appear to be sticking their heads in the sand.
Trade Desk got their identity solution. Yeah. Yep.
Mm. Of course. So I think it's not something that necessarily, you know, marketers are going to have to go through a huge and very, very steep learning curve and actually try. I think they're going to have to lead it, certainly from the advertiser side. Publishers are going to have to come together and lead it from the publisher side. And actually, I think it's quite a good opportunity for us to almost to reverse the roles that have been for the last 10 years or so, where we can start to dictate the terms on which we will work with people.
Mm. Does that, and from your point of view, does this sort of new landscape, I hasten to add that new should be in inverted commas because you're quite right, yes, disappearance of third-party cookies isn't new, but does this put you in a place in the industry where you feel you've got a lot more sort of bargaining power, particularly where as publishers, if you've got first party data, you can be starting to offer up audience targeting in a way that perhaps wasn't quite as alluring before?
I think it does. I mean, I think it has to, because we're the ones with the relationship with the consumer on one side, and obviously you've got the marketers with the ad, with the brands and their relationship on the other. There are ways to join those two together, but ultimately we know, I think of my own setup, I've got like 98 data points on every single user and they're all first party based. We don't use any third party data and haven't for a while. That data by its very nature becomes much more valuable, I think, to an advertiser than if I was, you know, than it is today and if I was using any third party data segment. So it has to, but I think it only works, again, if publishers work together on these things as opposed to trying to create, you know, thousands of separate little walled gardens.
Mm. And what's your point of view on that, the publishers working together? And I suppose what's your experience of that? Are you feeling like there's some publishers that are really willing to do that? Is there resistance across others? What's your approach?
I mean, I think we've had discussions with other publishers. We're members of Ozone, yep, for instance. And we're talking about it with them as well as a way that we can get those five publishers all to work together to have a common solution across everyone. And I've sat in rooms with publishers outside of that group as well. And there does seem to be there's less reluctance now. I think people are getting to the point where they're not seeing them, you know, we're not seeing each other as direct competitors anymore. We know that we are that 20% and actually the competitors are the 80.
20%ers.
Yeah.
Yep. Independent.
We've got to stick together.
Yep.
But I think that's where we're very quickly getting to, and people are starting to realise the need to
but
do
if you
that.
Imagine, if you imagine one thing, I think the Ozone thing is a great example of publishers being proactive rather than reactive. To, you know what I mean? They're not, they feel they can. If you think about like that collective, right? In the current environment, right? On a first party basis. So someone was saying, oh yeah, the advertisers will just spend more money with TV and Google and whatever else, right? But these sites that are within the Ozone family, they're incredibly rich in terms of like context and premium quality of content that is not available. Now you could run a poster campaign instead of doing display advertising, but the reality is you can still get first party targeting. You can still get first party measurement. But if you work together as a collective, you could build your own panel-based situation where you could actually give real attribution to the advertiser. So while I'm seeing is a lot of headless chicken strategy from the ad tech community and the likes of the IAB who are trying to basically say, we'll just solve the problem by creating a similar solution. You know, instead of JavaScript, we'll just use a hashed email. Jesus, you know, give me strength type thing. Like, you know, I'm not a religious man, but
I think it's God that gives you strength as opposed to Jesus.
God, you know, whoever, whatever, whatever fucking strain you're
religious
into.
Icon.
But I'm saying that is just trying to placate the current system. And I guess David's put it in the right way, saying that the power is swinging back to the publisher because they have the relationship with the user, right? The user comes to stylists because they love the content. They love the writers and there's no relation between ad tech and the users, right? And I think that's where publishers need to start going, wow, we suddenly have all the power again. Like we are now in the driving seat again.
And do you think, because the other point that the article made, you know, it was a thought-led piece.
It was a good piece though, in fairness.
It
that.
Was a really good piece. Yeah. A
very optimistic piece, I would
yes,
say.
Yes, and I thought as well, because the other point that the article made was that now is the time for experimenting, actually. And what the industry has done to date is just roll with various solutions as they've been designed, because everybody's been trying to kind of get on the bandwagon of opportunity. And it's sort of amounted to a bit of a race to the bottom in terms of the stability of some of the technology solutions that the industry has been dependent upon. Do you think that if there was a slightly different attitude within the industry, certainly perhaps since, say, you know, Apple killed third-party cookies in Safari, that maybe we would have been a bit more open to experimentation until now? It kind of feels like that headless chicken scenario that you're just describing, Kieran.
When you're addicted
maybe it's born out of the fact that people just haven't been prepared to experiment.
When you're addicted to something, it's very hard to get off it. So I just
I know I was going to say exactly the same thing. Actually,
too easy then.
What the death of the third-party cookie is forcing people to do is going to be to go cold turkey, which as
train spotting.
But it's exactly that scenario. You know, if we've not done it, I think it's not been done because we've always had the safe haven of Chrome. Now, if that's being pulled away from us, we are going to have to think differently. Otherwise, you're going to see companies disappear.
But remember that there's going to be some casualties here.
There's definitely going to be some consolidation.
And also rethinking. So, let's think about the ad server for a minute, right? So it'd be interesting to see if there'll be more innovation around pre-bid, and you basically coalesce the ad server 2.0 around that. And then have we moved to sort of like authenticated versus the unauthenticated web, the anonymous web, where the anonymous web is a contextual environment and the authenticated web is first party data. So I don't mean that by the hashed email where you can track users across different domains. I'm talking about if I have 1 million emails, I can match it one to one with an advertiser using a LiveRamp, but it's not broadcast out to many. There is an explicit connection between the two, the way the Facebook and Google work. Innovation like the likes of InfoSum, I know they're talking about it and they're still sort of, they're testing and learning quite a lot of their product, but they're doing some interesting stuff as well. Permanives of the World as well, they're doing some interesting stuff. So there is innovation happening in the space. I just think that we've built this multi-billion dollar infrastructure around matching cookie IDs, which now is not possible across several of the browsers, including Chrome, and also it's illegal in Europe. And when you've got the ICO investigating practices, and you've got the EU investor, and you've got people like Johnny Ryan running around suing everybody, you have to think differently about this. You need to start thinking about the user, right? That's something we've kind of almost, said, well, they're not paying us money, let's just ignore them. And I think there has to be that relationship, has to change. And I think that the publishers are in the driver's seat now here to change a lot of this. And it's very exciting because this is actually now, I feel in 10 years, because you could argue the last great innovation in this space was probably RTB, right? The RTP protocol, the growth of programmatic, which probably is exacerbated the cookie situation, in fairness, the irony of it all. But really now it's kind of like, will we see a whole wave of well-capitalized companies going, holy shit, there's $100 billion opportunity here that Google and Facebook won't be allowed to gobble up? Because they can't. They only have 60% of the web. What happens to the other 40%? There is a massive opportunity here. And I love this piece because actually it's just making people think, just rethink, test and learn. Okay, if that doesn't work, try something else. And it waking us out of our sort of this stasis we had for 10 years. We've had it too easy, I reckon. You know what I mean?
Sort of sleepwalking, I suppose, for the last 10 years.
And dependence on Google, it's like, I hate to even call Google a sugar daddy, but the kind of, the sugar daddy's been paying your way and sugar daddy ain't paying any more money.
Do you feel a sense of optimism on the publisher side of the industry?
Yeah. Mm. Short answer. Yeah, I do. I think we've worked really, really hard, and I think publishers have actually led that, going back to thinking about the user. I think publishers have already led that. If you look at a lot of the premium sites now, instead of peppering their users with, with an outstream and a skin and a floor banner and a pop-up and then 50 ads around the page, actually most quality publishers now are using less ads units. They're thinking about the UXs of the for the user a lot more. And that's only going to be a good thing. We will get there with the data piece. I think that's got to be the next bit that we look at. But there's no reason for us not to be optimistic.
Yeah. Okay, that leads me into the third story, which is focusing on the DTC world. We talked about this in our podcast last week, that a number of DTC businesses are potentially struggling. We sort of discussed theories as to why that might be the case, it being quite difficult to grow certainly small DTC businesses into brand recognized businesses. The article that I wanted to refer to today is a Business Insider piece that's talking about, while on the one hand you have funding for tech companies in certain sectors, like advertising, for example, quite difficult to get hold of these days, you're actually starting to see investment funding for tech companies that are helping brands advertise in particular ways coming forward. So the example that was brought forward in this particular Business Insider article are a couple of tech companies that have been funded who are helping brands advertise on the Amazon e-commerce platform. Now, the idea is that these are self-service tech platforms that help brands who are advertising on Amazon create and run their advertising campaigns, but also do other things that those brands need to do in order to be successful in an e-commerce marketplace, like design product catalogs, you know, measure their sales, you know, basically track their activity across the e-commerce platform. And what's interesting about these tech solutions is that they're not just therefore enabling advertising, which means their monetization model is completely different. They're offering themselves as a software service. So they're monetizing themselves through a subscription, if you like, or a recurring revenue fee, as opposed to a share of advertising. So I thought this was interesting because it says something a little bit about how DTC businesses might be operating and running, where the opportunity is for those businesses and where the opportunity is for tech platforms. And I suppose my question to you two is, do you think that this will become the sort of advertising of the future? It might not just be about what I'd refer to as broadcast advertising, but instead it might be about a bit more nuanced product discovery, whether that's in an e-commerce environment or whether that's in a different digital environment. I'm going to go to you first, Kieran, because James, I know you're going to have a lot to say about this because it will dovetail quite nicely into some of the things that you're working on at Stylist. So let's start with you, Kieran.
Yeah. So, I mean, the pieces about the investment, where the sweet spots in the ad tech world are. I mean, Amazon is all omnipresent. It is growing, and all the DTC brands would like to obviously push people to their own sites, but have realized that the eyeballs are on Amazon, and the fulfillment orders and all the rest of the Amazon offers is just it's too much of an opportunity to pass up. I said this 2 or 3 years ago. I thought that, you know, there's a ton of money that goes into in-store merchandising. You know, the likes of, like, you know, you have your product in M&S, and then you spend a ton of money on in-store merchandising, like, you know, advertising and TV and all the rest of it. You know, when that shifts into Amazon, I thought that there's literally $100 billion market here that will shift into those platforms, because Amazon is not stupid. They're saying, well, you're selling your product on our site, why not buy some ads to optimize the process? So it's just kind of like that logical sort of flow of money from the offline retail world into the online retail world. And we'll see a lot more of this. I think Walmart have got a sizable business in the US, and a lot of the French Carrefour and all those guys are doing something similar.
Well, this is the thing, you're seeing traditional brands really upping their e-commerce strategies and becoming e-commerce platforms themselves.
So I'm not surprised that you'll have specialist companies just leveraging the API from Amazon and building tools atop to help DTC brands to do that. But, you know,
See ad tech vendors get into that? So the two companies that were mentioned in this article, eTales and Tika Metrics, who are...
Why wouldn't you? I mean, like, this is the other misconception about ad tech. It's not just about retargeting display. Ad tech is about media execution and media monetization. So, you know, one API, you know, the APIs are everywhere. So, I mean, most of the DSPs and SSPs, well, not the SSPs, but DSPs have APIs to build products on top of. AppNexus is the greatest example of a quasi-platform in our space, where they had APIs where a ton of companies built off. So ad tech will evolve. I mean, Amazon's an opportunity. If I was looking to raise money now in an era where I know there would be instant business, then Amazon, because every day it's just not D2C brands, it's traditional brands.
Yeah.
It's like B2B brands. The market is absolutely massive. The opportunity is huge. So I'm not surprised that's a sweet spot. And we'll see like other scale entities like the Shopify's of the world, the Alibaba's of the world. There will be other opportunities there as well. But, you know, it's not surprising. And yes, you're right. Ad tech evolves, right? And the good talent that's kind of building SSPs and DSPs, they'll move into other areas. That is, all this is ad tech for me. Like, it's just,
And you can see why this is attractive from an investor's point of view, 100%. Investing in companies that have got a completely different type of revenue model.
And the growth is infinite, right? Mm. So, you're at the behest of a massive entity like Amazon. But the reality is Amazon just doesn't care about that business because it's too huge. They've got too many other plates in the air. They're not going to cut out the API.
Well, and the other thing is there are other e-commerce marketplaces in the world, like exactly. You said, Alibaba.
But the thing is that Amazon's just Lizard, so big that for them to take resource and build something competitive, I mean, there's always that threat where Facebook.
They could buy them.
Well, no, Facebook, I guess,
less
had their
so
API.
Probably after the first story today, but yes. You're right. They could look to buy them, but actually, if they're already under investigation, they're unlikely to do that. And it's
that's true. We go back to the first story about smaller acquisition to kill the ecosystem. I think this is just small fry for them. Like, you know, there are opportunities in the cloud, there are opportunities on their streaming service, their opportunity is e-commerce.
Yeah.
You know, there's bigger fish to fry for Amazon than just competing with smaller ad tech players.
Yeah. David? I mean, if I was a VC right now, I'd definitely be looking at this as opposed to looking at investing in ad tech, which, again, from the...
Hold on. As I said, ad tech's big.
It's all ad tech. I know it's all ad tech.
You mean display?
Traditional display ad tech, or people that don't have this e-com piece to their, you know, to their arsenal, because that is on a tight deadline now, you know.
Yeah.
So you're looking to get out within 2 years, and what the valuations will do depends. Whereas, as Kim said, that e-com piece is just going to get bigger. It's just going to keep going.
Plus, it's post-click. Remember that, right? It's not some weird religious post-views crap. It's actually post-click. It's like, I live and die by how many sort of acquisitions you get or how many sales you get. So, you know what I mean? That's why, if you get it right, you're just incrementally going to grow that. And the D2C universe...
That's why they're able to build a, you know, software-as-a-service model around
software
it.
As a service model, $100 or volume-based, recurring income. It's lovely. It's a lovely business. You know what I mean? If they get it right, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen ad tech companies try to go down that, or traditional ad tech companies, I'm going to be really careful with that now, to go down that route with the SaaS model, and they never, I don't think anybody's really cracked it yet. It's definitely, you know, there'll be losses at the start, but that's fine, because you know that once you get to a certain point, it will just scale infinitely. Mm. And it probably is going to be, not probably, it is almost certainly going to be a more profitable business in the long run.
So it sort of just leads me into wanting to talk to you in general about your e-commerce views, because just as we were, you know, sitting down enjoying a glass of water before podcasts, we were chatting about...
I was drinking Irish breakfast tea.
Kieran was drinking Irish breakfast tea. But we were talking about what you're up to at the moment, David, at Stylist. You were talking about some of your sort of diversifications in terms of monetization opportunities. So tell me a bit about those, and don't miss the e-com piece, because that was really interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I mean... ours is a business that is, you know, has historically been print based. We've got this unicorn publication that gets 400,000 copies every week, no returns. We could probably publish two if the advertising was there. You know, people seem to really love it, and they get annoyed if they miss it. And what we
it's good read,
it's a great read. And what we've been focusing on is making our digital properties equally as, you know, excitable for our users and compelling for our users. So, you know, we've looked at how users move around the website. We're looking at how we can get more content out to them through all channels. So things like through podcasting, or whether that's via social media, or, you know, via things like Apple News. And then the other one that we're looking at is in this e-com place as well, and how we could potentially move into that, which is exciting.
Totally. And so we have talked before about this notion of publishers becoming brands, brands becoming publishers, it strikes me as this is an opportunity for Stylist as a publication that has maybe seen how brands are marketing themselves and selling products to sort of step in and think, well, actually, we can help with that. We can do something similar. Is that where the e-com idea came from? And maybe talk a little bit about what the, you know, what you're planning on doing.
Yeah, I mean, for us, the idea came from the fact that we have something that we call the Stylist effect, which is we know that if we feature something in the magazine or we feature something on the website, it will sell. We've got enough testimonials now from brands and from advertisers that just said, you know what, we did this with you guys and we just sold out. And so for us, it was a sort of logical next step. As you look, there were all these really cool independent brands that we knew that our users would like, but they didn't necessarily have their own platform to sell on, or they were going to have to go through the likes of an Amazon or, you know, one of these huge platforms.
Bigger marketplace.
Whereas for us, we can curate a list of products for users and get them, you know, basically put them in front of those, you know, put these products in front of those users and act as the, I guess, the conduit for the actual transaction taking place, as opposed to working on an affiliate share of maybe 2 or 3%.
And so it's going to be your own owned and operated e-com platform available through the Stylist site, or is it going to be separate, standalone? How are you going to run that?
We're still working out a few of those details at the moment, so it's still in build. It's actually not due to launch until July.
Yep.
It will be definitely linked to the Stylist site, but whether or not it sits within that, not sure yet.
Yeah. Exciting stuff.
So would it be... I mean, did you bought a company about apparently for this? Is that can we say that publicly or not?
Yeah, we can say that. We've
say
already
it publicly now because you just said it.
It's on the podcast.
But actually, just building an e-commerce platform is a pretty big undertaking for a lot of publishers. But it does seem like a logical move for you guys, given the fact that you've such a strong reputation around product sort of reviews and sort of, you know, general sort of the items you talk about. So it does make sense to kind of finish that last mile, you know, particularly around like the high-end products. I mean, you could argue that, I don't know how you're going to structure this, but surely like the 1,000 or 2,000 pound thing or whatever price range, I'm not saying that there'll be that much. So the high-end stuff would be sold by you, and then maybe the lower-end stuff could be done by an Amazon or somewhere else. There's value that you can extract from that. I mean, there'll be some products that you will obviously, you know, want to have in stock, and then there's others like, because you do so many pieces, like you're not gonna have everything in stock. So it just seems like the logical thing to do from a product, because we've seen it with Dennis with that
Auto
car.
Trader.
That was not Auto Trader, the car review site that had, which is like used cars. So they review the used cars, and then they actually bought the actual car selling entity. You know what I mean? So they went from like end to end. I can't remember the name of the product they have, but it's been a huge success. So it makes sense that publishers would use that reputational thing that they have to help sell these products as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've always looked at it that, you know, one of the mantras of what we put out is that we don't want people to just go out and buy stuff. We want them to buy good stuff.
Exactly.
And actually, we are already curating these lists every week.
So curation is the key here.
Curation is the key here. You know, and working with brands who we would, as a magazine or as an individual within that magazine, that we would actually want to buy and, you know, we want to be part of Stylist as well. Mm. So yeah, it's really exciting time. I mean, there's a lot of work to do for it, but it's good.
And it's just nice. I mean, it's further to that brand extension, so it's something else for Stylist to be getting involved in, and it's a nice piece of monetization diversity, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we are a purely ad-funded business, so any way that we can... We've already spoken about the issues that we're going to have in that, so any way that we can move out of that, you know, we're looking at a fitness brand as well, Strong Women, that is launching at the end of this month. And that's just another way that we can just get away from this ad spend or purely ad funded model.
Yeah. Yeah. Car Throttle, was that it?
That's it.
Yeah.
I apologize to Dennis Publication. That great publication. I visit it every other week.
How would you pronounce that, Kieran?
trottle.
Mm.
Is that racism?
No.
I didn't invent this language.
Just enjoying a little bit of Irish.
I didn't invent this language. I told you before.
Irish vernacular.
The British occupied my country for 300 years and destroyed my language. So.
Oh, God, it's all going wrong.
I know, it is all going wrong.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to get political. Again. But no, but it's interesting that do you think that most publishers will have to go, like, they'll look at what can make the money, like, you know?
Well, I guess where they've got really good first
Commerce
party...
Commerce is a good opportunity.
Where they've got really good first party data and, you know, first party data segments, surely that's going to point them towards where they should be funneling their activity. Presumably that's part of what took you to where you are now, right?
Yeah, it is. It took us there with the Econ Play. It took us there with the with Strong Women as well, because we were seeing all of the data for us was pointing towards, you know, strength training for women being a huge growth area. So in which case it made sense naturally that we followed into that, and we've seen the same with the Econ Play as well.
And what are you going to open a gym?
No.
You're not.
No, we're not going to.
Are you going to be like a weight instructor?
I personally, no. I mean, with my arms, I don't think I could lift a 5 kilo weight. But
okay, so maybe the fitness
class.
But
you'll be class, a good ambassador for the brand, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably do jumping jacks, walking up the floor, four flights of stairs here.
Which we make all our podcast guests do. But it is interesting. I do apologize.
But it is interesting to see publishers thinking outside the box, particularly around this stuff, and realizing there is bigger opportunities. You know, like Google and Facebook, they have they own 80% of the ad market, right? But they only command about 60% of our attention online, right? Because they're funneling us from their own platforms into the sites themselves.
I'm surprised it's even 60%, actually.
Well, someone give me
I
that.
I thought it was less than
well,
that.
Well, between all the apps and all the rest. But they're funneling us, they funnel people into other content sites. And obviously they're trying to create their own, you know, their own ecosystem to keep people there. But the reality is, it's then up to publishers to capture the value. And commerce is a really interesting space. And okay, affiliate's working for a lot of publishers. Like as a revenue generator, it is working for them at scale. It does work. And you know what? Setting up an e-commerce site is not easy. So obviously, some of them have decided that's not for me. But there is pockets of opportunity. I mean, around this gym opportunity, you know, you could partner with a protein powder manufacturer for all. You could white label that and sell. I'm not putting ideas in your head, but the opportunity to spin out specific products off the back of that could be quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, I mean, well, the fitness brand is looking at a strength training program.
For there you go.
For instance, so we can, you know, we can get that in front of people and they can do it either at their desk we're looking at, or potentially in a gym or outside in a park.
Yeah.
Excellent. Strength training at your desk. I want to see what that looks like.
Well, you want a protein shake. You want a protein shake afterwards. That's what you need. And that's what you need the brand there, like, you know.
Yeah.
Strawberry protein shake.
All of it's pointing to a much more sort of, you know, interesting kind of publisher sell side conversation
it
for
is.
2020 and beyond, right?
It's getting the grey matter going, hey. That's the problem, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. For too long, we've had things done to us predominantly by ad tech and being told, you know, you can't use a subscription model unless you've got this type of content. I think the FT led the way there. But you're right. The more you see Dennis do it really, really well.
Yeah.
We've seen some bits come out of people like Amelia.
Future as well.
Future. The Economist is another really good one that have diversified. And it's just taking your model and going, well, how else can we spin this out and how else can we survive?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And hopefully beyond that, thrive as well. Yep. Exciting times. Right. We've run out of time. Thank you very much, David, for climbing the four flights of stairs and coming and joining us on the Magic Podcast.
Training.
Yeah, there we go.
I couldn't even get my gag in about haters gonna hate.
Oh, well, but you
but
got
I was
going to
say
there.
About Amazon oh, hating your. Yeah. I was Amazon hating your e-com platform. That was going
to
be
not a
segue.
Reference to David's surname then, no.
No.
Okay.
Oh, really?
It's like being 6 years old all over again.
Welcome to Exchange Wire,
where everyone behaves like they're 6 years old.
It's like
okay.
A playground in here. Where's the bouncy castle?
Thanks very much, guys. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.